Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams podcast. Joining me again, this time, a return visit to the podcast, is Diana Choileva of Inodo Economics. Diana is someone who spends her life looking at China, and I've been wanting to get her back on the podcast to talk about all things China for quite some time now, and we've finally managed to find a time to do that. Now, she, as you will hear, we were time constrained in this podcast because of some certain travel issues that I had getting up here. But we still had time for a truly fascinating conversation about China. We talk about a course that Diana is running, and she has very kindly offered to give subscribers to this podcast a 30% discount to that podcast. There will be a link in the transcript if you want to sign up for that. And you can go to the website, Enodo Economics, that's E-N-O-D-O Economics, to find out more about it. And then, as I say, use the discount code in the transcript if you want to sign up. So with that being said, I hope you enjoy my conversation with the wonderful Diana Choileva. Well, Diana, welcome back to the podcast. So good to see you again. Thanks for taking the time to join me on a Monday evening.
Thank you very much. My pleasure, as usual.
Well, the last time you and I actually saw each other was at a fantastic dinner we were both at in London, which is, gosh, it must be 3-4 months ago now, I guess?
Around about.
Yeah, I would think so. And my, oh my, the world has become more complex in those last 3 or 4 months, hasn't it?
It has. I mean, I would say that really since the global financial crisis, it's just been an exponential growth of the complexity. And the problem with that is, for me anyway, personally, that the way I forecast the future is to always try and identify what is the key driving force in the world. And then once you figure that out, then everything starts falling off that. But of course, that task gets harder and harder because there are so many variables in play at present, and then just keeps they just keep growing, not least the geopolitical events of the weekend. So yes, it has become very complex and very difficult to pull it all together into a coherent picture. But nonetheless, that's what we are there to do.
Exactly right. Exactly right. No matter how tough it might become. Well, listen, one of your most important focuses is, of course, China. And so that's what I want to talk about today and kind of get a sense from you as to as much of what we can understand is going on in China. Because it's, you know, it's funny. It's been such an important thing for so many people to understand China for such a long time. And I get the sense that people have become a little bit inured to it because there's always something happening in China. It's normally couched in the West as something bad happening in China. And, you know, I think after a while, people just have this tendency to hear China mentioned, and they've already kind of made their judgments about the bigger picture in China, and they file every single piece of news into the particular framework that they have. So I want to get a perspective from you because I know it's something you spend such a long time studying. So why don't we start domestically? And I want to come on to China's relationships, particularly with the US, a little bit later on. But let's start by getting like an overall sense of what's happening domestically in China, the strength of the economy, where the red flags might be. Just I'm going to throw you the ball and you just run as far with it and I'll hang on to for dear life.
Well, yes, you better hang on tight because if you give me as much freedom, then I won't stop talking. But no, by all means, please feel free to interrupt me with questions. But I mean, what I would say is that in my more than 20 years of covering China, this is really the first time I see it facing such huge challenges, but also a combination of huge challenges. I'd say this is the sternest test, actually, China is facing for the whole period of its opening up and reform. And on the one hand, you could trace it back to Xi Jinping arriving at the helm of the Communist Party, and then, of course, Trump's trade wars. And now, the most popular sort of comparison that we've seen of China is whether China is turning into the next Japan. I want to step back from the cyclical at the start of our conversation and look really at the long-term potential of China and what forces are shaping that. You know, as an economist, you are trained at university that the potential growth rate of an economy depends on the increase in its labor force, the increase in its capital, and their combined total factor productivity. Now, if we look at China's demographics, they're clearly bad and difficult to change with any policies, especially in the context of China not being open to immigration. Though, I'll open a bracket here, it's worth looking at its Belt and Road Initiative, not just from the perspective of its search for key commodities, but also it has invested in the economies which it hopes it will draw within its geopolitical sphere of influence and which will have some of the biggest populations globally by 2050. So there is a strategy there. And of course, we can discuss robotics in terms of supplementing people. But on balance, the demographics are a huge drag on China's future growth potential. Then we look at capital. China has been overinvesting since really 2004-2005. I was able to do that for so many years because first, it was eating up global market share like crazy, and it had this continuous influx of export income. After the global financial crisis, that was not possible. So what happened then was that it kept throwing money at unproductive investment, but at the expense of debt rising up as a share of GDP. And now our estimates for the credit losses in China this year are a shocking number, between 37 and 42% of GDP. I mean, that's one number, but it's one number that you're putting into this picture. So highly likely for years to come, China will actually have to shrink its capital stock, and there wouldn't be a positive contribution from the accumulation of capital, even if you start considering that they'll be investing in new areas in that time. So then really, it all rests on productivity growth. And if you look at the evidence over the history that we've been able to measure, really, the most fundamental impact over the long term comes from productivity growth. So if China is able to boost productivity growth, then it will be able to grow positively. It's not going to be growing at even the 4 or 5% that it has been growing at over the last few years, but it can grow at 1, 2, maybe 3%, which for an economy the size of China will be sufficient. But the big question is how can China boost productivity growth? And I think, you know, I sympathize with your sentiment about generally people thinking, oh, we know about China, and a lot of the time in the West, likely forming those opinions, reading Western newspapers and analysis. And I mean, I don't actually advise anyone to read the Chinese texts in a sense. I mean, it's so difficult. It's like swallowing sawdust when you're trying to read through and figure out what, you know, what they actually mean. But a big story on the productivity front is being missed out with respect to data. And of course, a lot has been written on how China sees the role of data. Whoever controls and has the most data, Beijing believes, will be the hegemon of the future. It's all about, you know, the quantity of data, the computing power with which you can crunch it, and then the hope that that will produce breakthroughs, innovations. I think that side has been written about and understood to an extent. And certainly Xi Jinping is putting huge weight on that. But I want to make another point, which is probably less understood, which I think is important to bring about. Because when Xi came to power in 2013, he made two statements. He said that whoever controls the data will have the initiative. And then he said that they'll let the market or market forces play a bigger role in the allocation of capital. And so how could these two be squared away together? Because we've seen this, what appears to us from the outside, a huge emphasis on party control, on state top-down directives, subjugating the needs of the private sector to those of the party, et cetera, et cetera. And that, in most people's sort of assessment, has led to the expectation that sort of China is reversing to becoming the Soviet-style command economy. And because that failed, China will fail. And I think that's too early to conclude that China is doomed to fail. It's doomed to become an ex-Japan, let's say, in terms of disappearing into insignificance. Because what the Chinese, I think, actually mean when they talk about market forces in relation to creating this digital economy, I mean, over the last 10 years, they have put huge amounts of efforts into creating the digital yuan, and that is on the cusp of being rolled out across the country. At that point, the Communist Party will have full visibility at such a granular level of all financial flows. And then they have also been digitalizing their logistics trade. And as that process is also gaining traction, they will then have the visibility over the physical flows in the economy. So they will be in a position to be able to see much better what is going on, which will give them the confidence to allow more flexibility in areas of the economy which they have previously sheltered. And in that sense, allow market forces to play a bigger role in the everyday life. Of course, everything will be subjugated to the needs of the party and to the vision of the party. However, if they succeed in creating this new world, because we have not experienced anything like this before, that's another critical difference with respect to Japan. When Japan was had its bubble and its burst and the decades of stagnation that followed, we weren't on the cusp of such technological change. And also, actually, it's important to note that Japan was a U.S. ally and is a U.S. ally, and China, of course, is not. So China will not, even if it goes down the route of Japan in terms of decades of debt deflation, then it's not going to go down quietly. So we'll have much more ruction in the world economy. So, you know, I'm not saying China will be successful, but I think it's important to analyze what they're trying to do. Will they be successful? When they talk about potential growth rates, they have added data as a separate factor of production.
This is why I love speaking to you, because I just get this massive data download and I've got to then try and sift my way through it. So a couple of things before we get on to what it means, China not going down quietly, which I'm curious to dive into. But let me go back to something you said a little while ago, which is that China 1-3% growth going forward, as opposed to the, you know, 6-8 up to double digits that we've kind of become used to. Now, we're at a point where the Chinese economy is changing and China's needs are changing. But up until now, the Chinese economy has been incredibly important for the world. Without that engine of growth in China, the rest of the world would have struggled much more. You know, China was the other side to an awful lot of things that particularly Western countries, but also its neighbors in Asia, expand and grow. Now, is that 1-3% growth in China, is that enough for the rest of the world? Is China growing at that level enough for the rest of the world? And if it isn't, what does that mean for the rest of the world?
I think the question we should be asking is what will the nature of that growth be? Because I would argue that China's growth over the last 20 years since WTO entry, more than 20 years, did not end up being a positive for the world as a whole. And we've discussed that during our previous talk. But let me put it in another way, because, I mean, essentially, China was so huge and it was bolted on to the global economy, which was a market economy at that point, predominantly sort of serving the needs of the free liberal democratic world. And then we bolted on China, and they were supposed to converge to being a market economy pretty swiftly, but they didn't. So we had them administering the price of capital globally and the price of electricity. Once, you know, so much of manufacturing moved across to China, we no longer had the production of global manufacturers based really in the inputs that go into that purely on the supply and demand principles. So I would argue that by incorporating China, it sort of looked we had Goldilocks for a number of years of strong growth and no inflation. And then it ended up actually in that massive debt explosion in the Anglo-Saxon world, which was really because China was throwing free money.
This is true. This is true. But I think the point I'm trying to make is that without China doing that, A, the US and the rest of the West would not have been able to rely on debt to solve the many problems that debt has solved. You know, the whole of the Western economy.
They wouldn't have built up that debt, you know, and that would have been, to my mind, a good thing. So what China needs to do in this 2 to 3% growth is to actually do so by consuming rather than just producing and grabbing export market share from everyone else.
The cost benefits that China's rise enabled for other countries did enable them to keep prices down, did enable them to keep inflation at bay when without China, inflation would have hit much, much sooner. Now, I take your point. Maybe if inflation had hit sooner, we wouldn't have had the buildup in debt that we had because they would have been forced to address it sooner. I totally agree with that. But this idea that China can go from producer to consumer is something that, you know, we've all wished for a long time now. This idea that the Chinese middle class will seamlessly rise up and take the baton and they're all going to be buying all the things that we're buying in the West just when the West runs out of capital and low-cost capital particularly to do so seems a stretch, particularly given the demographic challenges in China.
That's different. So, you know, I'm not arguing whether they will be able to produce consumer-led growth. I'm trying to say that they haven't had consumer-led growth. They were actually just taking export market share in the process, creating inefficiencies for the whole world because their system was command and control when it comes to key prices. So the pricing mechanism stopped working globally and we created a lot of inefficiencies, a lot of debt, a lot of excess. So I was just trying to counter the argument that China's rise in that sense was beneficial. And actually, if what happens next is not going to grow at 10%, but if it grows at 1 or 2 or 3, will that be enough? And I'm saying, actually, it would be enough if they do that. And if that is based on them consuming rather than just in a mercantilist fashion, grabbing export market share. So then it's a different question. Will they be able to produce consumer-led growth? Which, you know, I'm happy to share my views. I think they've been trying for a number of years and so far not succeeding. In fact, there was a period during which they succeeded, but that was bizarrely because of the demographics. Because what happened was that once the migrant labor force started shrinking, and then the total labor force started shrinking, finally labor in China was able to demand a larger share of income. And so wages started going up. And simultaneously, the authorities used the explosion of e-commerce to unlock the untapped spending potential in rural areas. In those areas, people earned very little but saved too much because they just simply couldn't buy what they wanted physically. You know, there wasn't the retail network. And so those two developments actually led between about 2013 and 2018 to some rebalancing towards consumer spending, but they ran out of steam. Because if you look at Chinese wages as a share of GDP, they're actually now on par with those of the US. So in terms of kind of the catch-up potential, that got exhausted. And if you look at household disposable income as a share of GDP in China, then that is much lower than the US. And the entire difference lies in income from assets. So here is where they continuously falter. And maybe if they do get this sense of control, once they've digitalized everything and could see it and could preempt problems before they become too big, maybe they'll allow interest rates to be set by the market. Because you've heard, and it's been the case throughout this whole time, that the Chinese households have been financially repressed. For a long time, the majority of their wealth was in interest-bearing deposits, which were practically nothing in real terms because everything was geared to offer low-cost credit to expand the industrial side of the economy. If you look at the wealth split these days, of course, the majority of wealth is in housing, and then in financial wealth, about a half is in equities and about 35% is in interest-bearing deposits, again, a very large share relative to an economy like the US or the UK. And on the housing front, they get no income because there is no developed rental market. The authorities tried to develop the rental market since 2015. They initiated a range of policies, structural changes in 2015. This was one of them. And if they had succeeded, it would have actually been very good. But so far, this one hasn't really worked out. And of course, Xi's attack on housing as speculation and that it should be just homes for living in has meant that the capital growth that households anticipated and relied on when it came to housing is now a thing of the past. So that has been a very large negative wealth effect on the Chinese households. And what's also interesting is that this housing boom in China was never accompanied, as in other economies, by the consumer boom, precisely because they just kept these properties unoccupied, empty. They didn't even kit them out because they weren't planning to rent them. And the reasons why the rental market is underdeveloped are, well, a lot of them. but some of them are quite deep and cultural. But it doesn't help that Xi yet again thinks about this issue from the perspective of the supply side. So he is now putting a ceiling on rental yields. So that doesn't seem to be moving in the right direction. And then you have the end of the shadow banking, which again, from a risk perspective, was a good thing, let's say. But actually, all these shadow banking activities, wealth management products, was just the way of the market to escape this financial repression and provide higher yields to households. That's now changed after years of de-risking. And we are back into household interest-bearing deposits, largely representing that chunk of their wealth. And we know that China is now cutting deposit rates, not just lending rates, because the banks will have to be the ones dealing with these massive credit losses. So then you look at the equity market, and that hasn't, you know, been a better yielding asset. But also it's looked at from the household perspective as a casino and not as a place where they invest for the long term. Now, again, the Chinese authorities are putting huge effort into professionalizing capital markets, developing them. If they succeed, this will be big plus in the future. But at the moment, or over the next 2 to 3 years, it's unlikely to see that materializing. So combine that with the experience of those in China that are under the age of 40, they have had their entire life just seeing progress, development, positive, and improvements. And all of a sudden, they had these 3 years of COVID and the zero COVID dynamic, zero COVID craziness, which, as some Chinese commentator summed it up, was the first time all these people had a very direct experience of everyday authoritarianism. So their confidence has been hurt, and they have been reminded quite powerfully of how hard life in China can be and how certain and how fickle. And as such, it's not a surprise that we've seen this huge increase in the savings rate in China right now. So the exact opposite to what the authorities are hoping to push forward. So the only way they have at the moment over the next few years to get some sort of consumer spending growth is through large fiscal transfers. But again, I told you the numbers on the debt front. So this means a huge increase in the government debt, which, you know, if they started doing that 3 or 4 years ago or around about 2015-16, when we had the previous debt scare, government debt then was about 45% of GDP or so. Now it's a lot more than that. I think it's over 70, 75, 78. I can't exactly remember off the top of my head right now. But from that level, to add the credit losses you have to write off and another 20% of GDP fiscal stimulus through these transfers, while simultaneously you are dealing with a much more hostile global environment, is a huge challenge. So when I talk about the sternest test, this is the nature of the problem that they face. And yes, she is putting a lot of store on this digital transformation, on the productivity gains, and on the sort of flexibility it could allow the party, as well as provide it with the control it craves simultaneously. But if they were to be successful at that, this is not necessarily going to show up in the next 2-3 years. Were they to be able to kind of manage to work out through these issues in that time, then we have to worry of what exactly world we'll be living in if they are successful at their kind of authoritarian version of the digital economy.
Well, so let me ask you then, because, you know, everywhere I look with China, my friend Marco Papic always talks about this idea of preferences and constraints. And we understand what the preferences of Xi Jinping particularly are. You know, obviously he needs social stability, he needs control, and he needs growth. Those are his preferences. But the constraints, you know, everywhere I look, I just see constraints in China, particularly the kind of constraints like demographics, which is not something you can do anything about. I mean, absent massive immigration. And I just don't see that, to your point about an increasingly authoritarian regime, I don't see how massive immigration is going to solve that. I see this massive debt overload as a huge constraint, as you pointed out at the top of the show, and the levels there are extraordinary. And then when it comes to the stock market, you're trying to change the nature, you know, of Chinese culture. That gambling culture is very much the way that the stock market has always been viewed. You know, I've spent best part of 20 years in Asia, and my friend Louis Garve tells a great story about, you know, going to the casinos in Macau with all his colleagues at GavCal in Hong Kong, and, you know, red kept coming up on the roulette every single time. It came up 6, 7, 8 times in a row, and all the Westerners started betting on black because the odds are that red's not going to come up again. And all the Chinese are saying, no, you ride the trend. This is how it works. You just keep betting red until it fails. And there is a gambling culture there. So to try and change human nature is difficult. And then when we get to this idea that digitization is going to make huge advances that will help ease the problems, again, you know, digitization is such a catch-all phrase for advancement. You know, when people talk about, oh, we're going to digitize this, people immediately think, well, it's going to be better because it's digital. And I just struggle to picture what that means in terms of the Chinese economy. So help me understand, given those constraints, given the kind of high level of those constraints and the intractability of certainly the debt, the demographics, and that human nature part of it, how are they going to thread this needle, do you think?
So what I've concluded is that you and Louis have certainly been having much more fun during your times in Hong Kong. When I lived in Hong Kong, I didn't go to any gambling. I remember actually celebrating my dad's 75th birthday in Macau anyway, and I was sort of dragging him to see if he wanted to play poker. He likes that, but no. So anyway, let me again try and explain what I'm trying to do, because I don't want to leave people with the wrong impression. At present, China is in a serious debt deflationary spiral. And as you mentioned, the constraints, or if you say the challenges, are huge ahead of them. But I have a high conviction that we are in the throes of what I have termed a slow motion real economy crisis, because I don't think it will be a financial crisis along the same lines as when liquidity dries up, because most of the debt is internal. They have control of the liquidity. It really is a solvency problem. And it will be a real economy crisis as such. And I tend to really look at and started thinking much more widely about the issue of incentives. Because you do change human behavior by changing the incentives. And under Xi, there's been a fundamental change in the incentives of many key groups in China. Starting with the private entrepreneurs, there were different reasons for the attacks on the education sector versus the technology companies versus the financial sector anti-corruption campaign that's ongoing right now. But nonetheless, there's this pervasive perception among private entrepreneurs that really, I mean, why bother? Why bother working hard when at the end of the day, I mean, at best case scenario, my assets are seized, and in the worst case scenario, I get thrown in jail as well. And so that's a really fundamental shift in the way. And even though he does not have anything against the private sector per se. In fact, he wants to develop and foster small and medium-sized enterprises, the growth of those. But by the way he has dealt with the big guys, has actually sent the wrong message and incentives across the whole sector, in my view. So he has a big problem there to get the animal spirits back. And then you look at local officials. One of the reasons China was so successful in the past was because it was progressing through trial and error, through a lot of experimentation at local level. And now that has changed because these guys are under relentless anti-corruption campaigns. Again, Xi is telling them, experimentation is important and don't just experiment for the sake of experimenting, but keep experimenting, and has this combination of conflicting signals as to exactly what the priorities are, as well as pressure to produce results in the context of this relentless anti-corruption campaign, is stifling local officials' desire and incentives to experiment and to be bold. And then we have young people. And actually, that's what should be the most worrisome when it comes to the long-term future of China, because there is a huge disconnect between young people's aspirations, what they have become accustomed to, and Xi Jinping's turgid ideology. And one of the answers to the surge in graduate unemployment that he has come up with is that those guys should be sent to the countryside, which of course brings memories of the Cultural Revolution. And this idea that he keeps putting forward that the young in China have to go through a lot more hardship is ringing hollow with China's youth, and you have such social phenomena as lying flat, not bothering to participate really in the productive part of the economy, which again is at odds with the continual optimism that the party tries to present and instill. So if I have to worry about, you were talking in the context of constraints, I prefer to talk in the context of incentives. This really is what I worry the most in terms of the ability of China to move on a sustainable development path going forward. However, I spent nearly 25 years, I guess, looking at China, and from between 2000 and 2007, 2008, it was the China dream. So I remember in Hong Kong, when I was leaving there, my colleagues put me in a... Did I tell you that story?
No, go ahead. Tell me the story.
Oh, because, they go, oh, you are a China bear. I was just saying, I'm not a bear. I'm just trying to explain how it works, and it doesn't work. The China dream has huge costs attached to it. Anyway, they dressed me up as a bear on my leaving drinks in 30 degrees heat. So I didn't like the sort of description China bear even before that, but certainly after that, I hated it. So now, perversely, and I don't do it for the sake of being contrarian, I'm not afraid to think differently and to put my head above the parapet, that's for sure. But what I'm trying to say is that there is more to China than this total, you know, this decline, these challenges that we talked about. There is another side to what they're trying to achieve, which I think is talked less about. Yes, it's going to be huge. And I'll again go over the digital side of things. And it's not just calling it digital, it should be better. In fact, I mean, if you ask me, lots of things that are digital are worse. But what the party sees in that is important. So it's not easy to see them being successful, but they could be successful. They have a huge desire to succeed in any case and determination to do so. So I just think we should not underestimate them. So that was the point I was trying to make at the start, that it's interesting when we look at, you know, yes, it's easy to see the demographics, the capital story, we're all focused on that, but I've heard a lot less people talk about the other side of things that they're trying to do. And it's important to understand that as well. So by the, again, digital, it's not that, calling it digital must be better, but it's that it allows them to achieve this, what previously was impossible. They wanted to have full control, but then simultaneously they were seeing that introducing market forces was positive for the economy in terms of industrialization, accumulation of wealth. And actually, interestingly, Marx or Engels never talked about a central authority setting all prices. That's Stalinism and not what at the origins Marx, who was an economist, envisaged. And so they struggled, you know, and I remember organizing an event in London in 2019 with, by then, the former PBC governor, Joshua Chuan, with Mervyn King, Martin Wolf. We were just discussing the future of the global financial system. And it was interesting how Joshua Chuan was talking about the challenges they faced. They generally wanted to open up the capital account, but every time there was something coming up. So you could understand that it was hard. Nonetheless, I think they should have done it sooner, but they didn't, because it ultimately really touched this issue of control. So the digitalization here is for them fundamental, because it will allow them to have the visibility across what's going on in the economy to then feel more in control. I mean, I give the example of, well, every child in the UK these days, I think, is monitored on their phone by their parents of where they're going. I probably was the only mother that I know of, well, no, I actually know of another one in my circle of mothers, who asked my children first, do you want me to do this? Do you want me to monitor you? Or would you explain the pluses and minuses, or you prefer not? Anyway, my kids said no, by any means. So I end up waiting for them at car parks because, you know, they're delayed, whereas all the other mothers have seen on the phone that they hadn't even left yet, so they're all arriving on time. I bear the brunt of giving freedom. But anyway, so, you know, all these mothers watching these kids on their phones going everywhere, and they feel more secure in allowing the kids to do more in London because they have that visibility. They can see where the child is. So this is kind of the type of dynamic that the Chinese Communist Party is trying to achieve more broadly across the whole economy. So they're hoping that instead of having to clamp down on the property sector when they did, which we could argue was probably already too late, they could have seen the problems at their genesis much earlier than that. One aspect of why they went so hard on the tech giants, of course, someone like Jack Ma and a lot of the others have become too big for their boots. They represented a political challenge. But importantly, also, these guys weren't giving the data to the Communist Party that the Communist Party demanded. And so it was a lot about acquiring that data, that granularity. So It's in this context that digital won't be better. I mean, you could argue, is that good for the human being? Anyway, that's, you know, we go more into the philosophical discussion there. It is about the fact that it will allow them to achieve two contradictory goals that they have had to struggle with continuously through this opening up and reform in the context of a communist party in charge.
No, I totally understand your point. I think for me, based on just about every government I've seen, the more control they have over commerce and business, the worse things get, not the better. So I guess we'll find out. You know, I worry.
I'm saying that because they'll be able to see what's going on, they'll give more control. So they'll allow, let's say, more banks to lend to, they've been pushing the banks to lend to SMEs, et cetera, but they'll allow market forces to determine interest rates and exchange rates eventually when global payments are digital too. So at the everyday level, they allow more freedom because they feel that if a problem arises, they can see it at the start and they can interfere straight away. But that is really, we're talking beyond the next 2-3 years of the debt workout, which is going to be extremely painful. So before we get to this digitalization, I think the real issue is how will this all play out? And you were right to ask the question about the global economy, because there's not going to be any help from China. So if you're relying on Chinese growth to somehow come and help the rest of the world in the next year or 2 years, that is not a scenario that seems highly likely. And will that weak growth, that hardship, start to lead to other outcomes that are even less savory?
Right. Well, I'm watching the time like a hawk because I know you have time constraints at your end. So let me just pivot before we finish it, because I want to talk about U.S.-China relations for a very good reason, that you're involved in something along those lines that I want to talk about. But just give us, you've got 10 minutes and I'm not going to interrupt you because I want to get as much of your time as we can squeeze in. Just give us a sense of where U.S.-China relations are right now, the potential threats, the potential white swans that may come out of it, and then talk a little bit about your initiative that you're planning for the end of the year.
So Xi Jinping and President Biden look like they're set to meet. And we've had a lot of high-level interaction in the last few months. So it would appear that there are efforts now on both sides. For some time, it was just on the side of the U.S. and she was ghosting America. But both sides appear now to be wanting to put a floor under the very rapid deterioration in bilateral relations. Will that change fundamentally the situation we find ourselves in? Highly unlikely. Right. Neither side is prepared to give the real concessions that the other one wants. What was unnerving the American side and actually causing problems with their allies was this lack of communication full stop, because that didn't look like a careful, thought out management of global power relations. So it was to an extent under the pressure of the G7 that the US was pushing to have communication with China and to manage this relationship responsibly. But this is a battle of ideologies. And as such, neither side is converging on the other. And the motivations and rationale behind the decisions that are being made are driven in China by considerations that in the West are often misunderstood, and actually in the West are driven by considerations that China misunderstands about the West. Communication between those two cultures is a very tricky thing. So one area where we haven't seen communication improve in the last few months is military to military, which is critical with respect to all the heightened activity on both sides of the equation in the Taiwan Strait and in the South China Sea more generally. If there is an accident there, the potential for this to escalate is now much higher because of lack of such communication. So it will be a good thing for markets more broadly and China's equity market more specifically, to see a floor in this continuous deterioration, some more talking. But do not expect any significant change in the direction of travel. And this was something that we decided to create in response to our clients sharing with us that they sort of feel like they've come into the middle of the book in this Sino-US confrontation. You know, they understand very clearly why it's so fundamental, why it's so important, and why it impacts absolutely everyone, and they should understand it. But they feel they've been thrust without knowing the background and without understanding the history, the position of each side. And so we decided to create an interactive but online-based short courses on US-China relations and what's at stake, where we look at every aspect of the relationship. The most recent history, though we go back further than that, but it really has been made very contemporary. We address the issues that everyone is thinking about right now and how we got to that point. So then everyone would be in a position to place everything in the context and make their own judgments, as well as make judgments on who to listen to and how to understand the issues.
Yeah, look, it's so true. And I think there is so much smoke around China that trying to understand the reality, it's very difficult to find people to listen to. You know, I have three or four people who I listen to. You're one of them. You know, Louis is one of them. There's a couple of other people that I listen to. And I don't always agree with their opinions, but I know they understand more than I do. And I try and synthesize that information. So, you know, offering a course like this for people to help them understand how to look at China, which is such a difficult thing to do.
The main thing as well is that the issues are so wide that you want something concise. And what we try to do is have around 5 hours of video content in bite size of 7 minute, 10 minute videos. So it's very easily digestible. But then you have another 5 hours of interactive Q&A with myself and my colleague, Nigel Ingster, who is our director of geopolitical analysis. So everything you've learned, you'll be able to discuss and bring to what does this mean about what's happening right now.
Well, but before, I've got one more question to ask you, but just before I do that, just let people know how they can sign up. I think there's a discount to register for the China workshop. How do people go about doing that?
Well, the easiest way to do that will be to go on our website, so www.enodoeconomics.com, and you will see a tab for training. So there is a place where you can add your email. As I'm looking at the page right now, I can see there is a 10% discount available if you go through there. But for all of your listeners, we are happy to offer a 30% discount. And I can give you a separate link for that everyone can click on.
Okay, I'll put that in the transcript. That's fantastic. Thank you. That's very kind of you. Well, listen, before you go, I got one more question, and that is when you said that, you know, China wouldn't be going down quietly, just give us a sense of what that means for the world.
Well, the biggest issue is whether China and the US will go to war over Taiwan. The Communist Party, and here it's important to say that Xi Jinping in particular, has said that there is no rejuvenation of the Chinese nation without unification with Taiwan. And Xi, given his age, the deadline, if he wants to be the leader that unifies, is about 2035 at most. And everything that we have analyzed in terms of what he has done, even more importantly than what he has said, suggests to us that he wants to be the leader to unify Taiwan. And this will be huge risk for the Communist Party, because if they fail, and a failure could be getting bogged down in a long war rather than losing out completely. And bear in mind that the PLA is preparing for the contingency that the US will get involved, although, of course, they hope that they wouldn't. The risks the party does know are high. And the US, on the other side, knows that if China were to unify with Taiwan, it loses its position as a hegemon in the Indo-Pacific. And so that rewrites the global geopolitical rules of engagement completely. So it's unlikely that the US will sit by and not get involved if China were to use military force to regain Taiwan. It's not clear what the US would do if all of a sudden Taiwan turned and said, we want to unify peacefully. However, that's not highly likely, looking at what has happened in Taiwan, in particular in reaction to China's brutal treatment of Hong Kong, and all the polls are suggesting that the Taiwanese are not of the mind to unify peacefully. So when I say China wouldn't go down, what I mean is that it has huge global geopolitical ambitions. At the bare minimum, it wants to unify with Taiwan, which is the biggest risk facing everyone in the world, and certainly a risk that should be clearly understood in this course. I mentioned we explain everything to do with the economy, everything to do with technology, but also we look at the military side of things and what are the parameters you have to think about when you think about Taiwan. And in a situation where the economy is faltering, on the one hand, some people are asking, oh, does that mean that they would delay invasion of Taiwan because they don't feel strong enough to do that? And others are asking, oh, well, does that mean that because of domestic problems, they'll try and rally the nationalist spirit and invade Taiwan to distract from the domestic problems? Well, I'm hoping that those who enroll in the course that I'm trying to promote will actually be able to answer for themselves after taking the course.
That'll be helpful. So now, does the current situation in Israel increase the chance that China will use this as a window when they know that the Americans are distracted further, or do you think we're not there yet?
We're not there yet, because the Chinese are putting a lot of effort and hopes on the Taiwanese elections that are coming up in January. I would say that while the war in Ukraine changed, and in particular then afterwards the failed mutiny by Prigozhin changed China's calculus with respect to Taiwan in unfavorable ways, this probably changes it in favorable ways, because it is an additional pressure on the US. But China also has significant economic interests in Israel as well, as it had in Ukraine. So it is not so black and white for them. But the main thing is that at this point in time, they are still trying to do a lot more of the carrot and stick, rather than, you know, our assessment is that they haven't given up on the peaceful reunification yet. And so risk of a military invasion of Taiwan by China at present on a 3 to 6 month horizon, we estimate to be about 15%. The risk of an accident is higher at 55% because of all the increased activity and because the two are not talking yet. Certainly not talking military to military.
All right, we'll see. Diana, I've kept you for longer than I promised I would, for which I apologize sincerely.
But it's always a pleasure.
I will wrap up and tell everybody where they can find you so you can run off and do what you have to do. My thanks again for taking this time, and thanks for kind of accommodating my travel chaos and squeezing this anyway. Thank you so much.
No, my pleasure. Thank you very much. And until the next time.
You bet. I look forward to it. Thanks, Diana. Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Well, boy, I wish we had more time. I'm going to have to get Diana to come back on. There's always so much to talk about with China, and being time constrained again is never the best way to go about that. So I definitely felt like we left more things on the table to discuss. So my thanks to Diana, and I will do my very best to get her back on the podcast again soon. Just to remind you, her website is Enodo Economics, ENODOeconomics.com. And if you look at the transcript, you will find a 30% discount code for the course they're offering on understanding China-US relations, which I think will be invaluable going forwards. And also, if you don't follow Diana on Twitter, you will find her at Choi Leva. That's Choi Leva. And she is an absolute essential follow if you pay attention to China. That's it for me for another episode. I will be back again shortly with a new guest. In the meantime, as always, thank you so much for listening.
Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.